Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Governor Gavin Newsom has become one of the loudest and spirited voices for the Democratic Party, and on a national stage has seared his ideological and political differences with Republican governors. But although Newsom makes his fair share of public appearances here at home, a one-on-one sit-down about issues facing Californians is difficult to come by. Well, a window of opportunity opened up last night. At the California Museum in Sacramento, Governor Newsom took part in a live, candid interview about all things politics in the Golden State. The conversation was hosted by Politico's California Bureau Chief Chris Catalago, who has long covered the state capitol. And hopefully, after a good night's sleep, Chris joins us with some of the best moments that bubbled up to the top. Chris, thanks for making the trip.
Of course. Thank you.
Nice to see you in person. So this sit down was months in the making. What went into making this happen and in front of a live audience, no less?
Yeah, this was great for us. Getting the governor to talk about both state issues and national issues. We're in the midst of a big expansion in the state. Obviously, Politico is really built out in Washington, D.C., and has had a presence here with Playbook for several years, I think back to 2015, with Carla Marinucci sort of pioneering that. But now we have a number of policy beats from education to healthcare, a new climate newsletter. And so this was really kind of a venue to get into a lot of those policies. As you say, it's the governor's kind of can be a challenge on some of these issues. Some of these bills are still pending. You know, he may not say definitively if he's going to veto them or sign them. He may not say definitively on the insurance issue that you mentioned, whether they'll do like a special session or an executive order. But you do get like a pretty good sense from him about what they're going to take action on, how he's kind of leaning on one bill or another. And I think it was helpful for folks on the policy front. And then on the politics, he's done the DeSantis thing. I think we'll increasingly see him as a kind of attack dog for Biden and Democrats in the coming months and even couple years.
Given that you have a long perspective of not only California politics, you worked at the Capitol Bureau with the Sacramento Bee, you just came from D.C. covering national politics and the Biden administration. What stands out to you about Governor Newsom over the years?
Yeah, I mean, lately it's been really interesting because he does feel very much like he's in a different phase of his governorship. Like, he survived this recall. He was very easily elected. He doesn't stand for re-election in California again in this role. And so maybe he's freer on some of these issues. One thing that stood out to me from last night was the fact that the state is going to get involved and file an amicus brief in these cases having to do with judges basically preventing city officials, mayors, from sweeping these homeless encampments. Obviously, that goes back to COVID and even before that. Some of these things, I think he's sort of reveling in this idea of like challenging, Democratic dogma on some of these issues. I know London Breed is on that side as well in San Francisco, but I think he feels like, I mean, he said this to us in prior interviews, like he feels like people are really fed up on some of these issues. They've gone on for too long. And it also sort of coincides with where he might want to go in national politics. I mean, California can be pretty out there in terms of its progressivism. And sometimes some of these issues are kind of explained in terms of looking out for humanity and people who I'm not questioning sort of where they're coming at it from, but they do come at it from a place that is probably far further left than the rest of the country. And when you're looking at this from a national perspective, I do think he sort of wants to see himself as moving a little bit to the middle on some of these things.
The conversation last night, I mean, it was scheduled to span 30 minutes, but it went longer. Yeah, the governor didn't seem like he was in a rush. And as you and I both know, that can go by in a blink. You know, how did you focus on what topics and issues to prioritize?
Yeah, I mean, I think in these sorts of sit downs, if you're just cutting someone off and they feel like they're not having a chance to, in this case, the governor, talk about the things they want to and sort of go through the list of what the state has done on homelessness. He gave a very sort of long setup about the billions of dollars that have been spent. You know, they're unlikely to go as long as you said he did. So I think there's kind of a give and take, right? We want to get our questions out. We want to sort of press him on things and make sure that he's like as best as we can addressing them. And he wants to sort of talk about all these things the state has done on these issues. This is true of probably every politician where they feel like they've done all these things and people would feel differently if they just knew everything about all of this. Of course, they don't. You know, I mean, the people obviously are not aware of everything the state has done on homelessness. All they do is they look out there and they see the issue and they think it's bad. And so, I think being able to have him explain some of that probably contributed to how long he went. And I think the other big one was climate. He's going to be in New York. And then, of course, China, which mm-hmm. he announced last night to talk about all the things the state has done on the environment and climate. And I think that's something that, you know, we saw with the previous governor is something that they take a lot of pride in, something that politically is still, I mean, Joe Biden has done a lot on climate. You know, you look at polls and it's obviously an increasingly big issue, especially for young people. But, you know, in terms of whether it resonates politically, it's a tough political issue. And the state for a long time, California has led the way on that. And so I think they take a lot of pride in doing that, whether it's Trump or Biden in the White House. Mm.
The governor mentioning the trip to China was new, and you touched upon, I believe, like roughly a dozen topics and issues facing California. Aside from the upcoming trip to China, did he say anything last night that gave you a deeper understanding, anything new for you aside from that trip, or was it more a reinforcement of where he stands on these big issues?
I do think that on the homeless issue and filing, on the on some of these other ones, there were folks who felt like on this issue, a number of school boards have taken up this issue of notifying parents if a child tells them that they're trans. And I think that there was a question. Newsom has talked a lot about these book bans. He was down in Glendale in L.A., L.A. area, talking with parents. He gave this kind of long, pretty nuanced answer about that issue and said it's like it's not all these parents' fault that have gotten very like ginned up over this issue. They're being stirred up over it. But there was also a real kind of defense of folks who want to accommodate these kids who feel like they're being called out. He talked about the suicide rates there and all of that it comes after that. We did hear from people who thought that he was dodging is too strong a word, but that he was not emphasizing that issue, especially over the last few weeks, couple months as these school boards have taken it up.
Yeah, there's a half dozen so far in the state school districts.
Yeah. And I think we've talked to him about this before. I think, you know, it's one thing for him to talk about this happening in Florida or another state where he's sort of at odds with the governor, or maybe even a red state like one that Sarah Huckabee Sanders is governor in. And it's another, I think it for him, it might be takes it even more personal when it's happening in California.
Yeah, a state that is supposed to be, you know, among the most or the most progressive in the nation. You touched upon homelessness and housing, and you led with that in the conversation, and that really wasn't a surprise. But what I found interesting is your first question really focused on this secretive plan by tech investors to build a new California city in Solano County. Why lead with that?
So it's a big story, still really developing, and the fact that he hadn't talked about it yet, I think, was interesting. I think that answer was really interesting to me for a number of reasons. One, he sort of called people out for immediately jumping to this being China. that is buying up this land around the military base, and basically saying it was like xenophobia and maybe kind of getting into this like misinformation topic, you know, disinformation that once this you put this thing out there, it kind of takes on a life of its own. The other one was, you know, this is controversial in part because, and he did say this, basically these folks who have these tech billionaires, investors who have envisioned this, one of the reasons that they're kind of back on their heels right now, and they've been criticized by folks like Garamendi and Thompson and others in the House, is because of the secrecy and the fact that they wanted to kind of, you know, acquire this land and do all this in secret. And, you know, as we know, politicians don't like that. You know, they don't like not knowing. And he told us he didn't know either.
He said he
found out 5 minutes before, and he still has a meeting next week with some of the planners for it. So, you know, on the one hand, he really feels like the state needs a lot more housing. So you might think that there would be some sympathy for that, especially if the community supports it eventually. You know, there'd be a whole campaign. And on the other, it's, you know, environmentally, is this more sprawl? Is this another example of it's a real question about where do you build? What are the resources for it? And then once you get beyond this whole question of the kind of what's going on with these tech investors.
When talking about housing, I mean, you also touched upon insurance companies that are pulling out of California. I mean, the first year of State Farm and Allstate. And the governor has talked about this. We've had conversations about this on Insight as well. Did you get a deeper understanding of perhaps any accountability on the state side? You know, these insurance companies are saying California isn't as friendly of a state. It's difficult to do business in California. Because when I was listening to his responses, I mean, there was a lot of focus on, you know, the same things happening in Florida.
Yeah, I think, you know, California certainly doesn't want to be Florida, where rates have just skyrocketed and it's just been a huge issue. They've had to come back and they had a special session. No matter how you cut this, and I don't want to sort of put, I don't know exactly where the blame lies. We have a obviously elected insurance commissioner. We have folks in the legislature. And then, of course, the governor's office, which is, I don't think had a lead role in these discussions, but it's obviously been part of it, as he said, for months now. I mean, the fact that they did not get a deal done to address this in some way in this end of session, we know that because we passed this marker where you have to have a bill in print for a number of days before. So basically it's done for the session and they're going to come back and do these hearings, is really kind of a failure of all of these folks. And I think the governor knows that. Again, is it the commissioner? Is it the legislature? I think that they really wanted to get something done on this. Next year, there'll be new leadership, dynamics change. And meanwhile, people are still not able to get insured. It really, I think one thing the governor did was stress that this like really is, and I think he said a red, what did he say? Red flag issue or something.
And that it's not unique to us. You know, he said it's America's coming attraction.
Yeah. And that's the climate part of it, right? Mm-hmm. Is that increasingly these areas become difficult to build. But I will say that, you know, that's true. But another piece of this is there are homes in, you know, not in flood zones, not in fire zones, like areas that you would think could far more easily be insured where folks are not able to get policy. So this is affecting people who are, you know, not just building in these areas where or buying homes in these areas where people say, well, is that responsible? Is it not? You know what can happen there. This is happening just in other parts of the state that were deemed safe for many years where they can't get a policy. And, you know, it's really incumbent on these state officials, even if this is a political hot potato. I mean, I think they saw, you know, it's not popular to raise people's rates. I mean, if there's a surcharge there, and I think the legislature recognized that. I think the insurance commissioner recognized that. And so they're going to have to deal with this. And I also just, you know, the public doesn't really care who, I mean, you get elected to do difficult things. That's why you put yourself out there and do this. And so there's a lot of frustration on that issue. There's a lot of frustration from the insurers themselves that this didn't get dealt with.
towards the end of your conversation, you did a rapid fire with the governor. And obviously, Governor Newsom, in recent months, obviously leading up to a presidential election, his name gets brought up a lot on whether he's going to run. He repeatedly says no, and he is a big supporter of President Biden. I mean, you asked him, you know, point blank, will Biden be the nominee? And he said yes. But you also went ahead to the election for 2028, right? And you said, is it time for a woman? And he said, you know, absolutely. I'm curious, do you think he was surprised you didn't directly ask if he was going to run? Because he gets that question, you know, time and time again.
Yeah, it felt like, we've asked it so many times. It felt like we had to get a little bit more creative and ask it in another way. I wonder if maybe he thought it was going to be about him. And on the question of whether it's time for a woman, I mean, it wasn't the world's toughest question, I guess. You know, he did say it is time for a woman, but then he also kind of, I think, ended that answer saying, you know, the most qualified candidate. So a little bit, left himself a little bit of room in that answer for himself in 2028. So we'll see. I mean, these things, we started off talking about how different the whole world looked for him just a couple of years ago. I mean, these things move so quickly, and people are in the limelight, out of the limelight, in favor, out of favor. I mean, there was this recall attempt and we were in the middle of COVID and everything looked terrible. And now he can kind of gallivant around not only the country raising money, but the world with this China trip and things, you know, he's sort of riding high at the moment. A lot of this for all these younger Democrats will really depend on what happens in this 2024 election. I mean, Biden being reelected is a lot different than if, you know, the Republican most likely Trump wins. And that would just like open the floodgates on the Democratic side. I mean, the primary would start the day after that election if Trump wins. There would be nothing holding back any of these folks. There would be no sort of hierarchy within the Democratic Party. Gavin Newsom would be free to do whatever he wanted. And so, you know, as with everything, a lot of this is outside of their control and things can change very fast.
Chris, thanks for making the trip and the conversation.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Chris Catalago is Politico's California bureau chief discussing his sit down with Governor Newsom. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A few simple yet powerful questions could lead to a major shift in the way people struggling with drugs in Sacramento are offered help. The county is experiencing another year with high numbers of fentanyl-related deaths. Now, those who go out in the community and do outreach with the unhoused population, they're starting to change the way they interact with people who use drugs. In addition to passing out care kits with Narcan in them, that's the drug that helps reverse an overdose, volunteers and staff are digging deeper by asking people about their past, their early childhood, to see if trauma and harm may have led to their reliance on drugs. CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf recently joined a team of outreach workers in Del Paso Heights and explains how they're testing out new approaches to lower drug-related deaths in the neighborhood. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Vicky.
So before we get into the specifics of what staff and volunteers are doing differently, let's get a lay of the land in terms of where Sacramento County stands in terms of fentanyl-related deaths.
I started looking into this after I was invited to attend a Fentanyl Awareness and Action Summit last month, and I found out so many interesting things, including the lay of the land in Sacramento County. So to go on a nationwide level, deaths from drug overdoses have doubled in the U.S. since 2015. So there were 52,000 drug overdose deaths that year, and there were 107,000 last year. A large driver of that is fentanyl, which is prescribed in hospitals as a painkiller, extremely powerful painkiller, but it is manufactured illegally and has infiltrated the drug supply. In 2018, 17 people in Sacramento County were dying in part because of fentanyl. And last year, it was 230. So that's 17 compared to 230 in just a 5-year time span. So I spoke with Lori Miller from Sacramento County Health Services about the data, and here's what she said.
We're seeing higher rates in particular areas and demographics, but it really, you know, spans all age ranges, and it really doesn't matter, you know, what area or socioeconomic status somebody is, because fentanyl does not discriminate.
And the Sacramento Coroner's Office has a dashboard where you can see how fentanyl-related deaths are changing over the years, and they're not going down, right? And what Lori Miller says is really true, that you can see that they exist everywhere, right? They are in all age ranges, also all areas of Sacramento. I will say 75% are men, and most people are housed that are using drugs and dying from drugs. But more and more, it's trending towards affecting Black people and unhoused people more than it has in the past.
And this isn't your first report on the effects of fentanyl in Sacramento County. This is part of a series or ongoing reporting that you're looking into. For this piece, you talked to people who are living along the bike trail in Del Paso Heights. What did you hear from them in terms of, you know, fentanyl and also their living conditions?
I spoke with a man named Joseph who had just gotten out of the hospital that day after unknowingly taking fentanyl. He smokes crack cocaine, and he says he thought he was smoking that, but when he woke up in the hospital, he was told he'd taken a life-threatening dose of fentanyl. And it's very easy to take a life-threatening dose of fentanyl because just a little bit can kill you. And this is something you hear from people who use drugs all the time, that fentanyl is everywhere, right? It's gotten into the drug supply, and a lot of people don't want to be using it, but once you start taking it, it can really get you hooked. And to him, he said housing is the solution for him. And he's been living out there 6 months and is on a waiting list. But he says living on the street, living along that bike trail keeps him coming back to drugs.
You know, just like when you go by the store every day, you get a soda. You know, you go by the store to get soda. You go by a coffee shop to get coffee. You know, you come down this block right here, this block is drugs. You know, because that's what they got to do. That's what they have to survive on. You don't have no job because where you live at, you live in a tent.
So again, Joseph told me he's been on a waiting list for housing for 3 months. He's hoping to get connected soon.
And when you talk about that lethal dose, one of the most striking images the DEA posted, I mean, the lethal dose, potentially lethal dose of fentanyl is like the tip of a pencil, the lead tip. It is that small. Fentanyl in prescription form, though, I mean, it's been around for decades. Did you learn why fentanyl now is so popular? Because it's being mixed in with other drugs.
Right. It boils down to fentanyl is extremely cheap to manufacture illegally and very potent. So suppliers will skimp on the real drug and then cut the supply with fentanyl to make it stronger. And it's often the supplier doing this. Often the dealer of the drug doesn't know until someone overdoses. And when people do, you know, have exposure to fentanyl, a non-lethal dose, it can be extremely addictive if you do get hooked.
Hmm. So you met with the team, and they're made up of staff and volunteers from a nonprofit called Neighborhood Wellness Foundation. What's their mission?
It's really an amazing place, the Neighborhood Wellness Foundation. Their mission is to disrupt generational trauma and poverty in Del Paso Heights. They do food drives, diaper drives. They have a quiet place for students to study, safe places for people to meet. I mean, there's always food there, it seems. And it just is a really cool building in Del Paso Heights. Dr. Gina Warren is the organization's director, and she says that the crack epidemic in the 80s wiped out kind of a village of generational wisdom and earning power in that neighborhood. So now the mission of the organization is to go out and try to bring love and food and supplies and a non-judgmental attitude to people. I think Dr. Gina Warren is a bit of a magnet. A lot of people have gravitated to this place as a model and as a place where they want to be. I talked to a neighborhood navigator named Sam Dinkins before we went out about whether he knew anyone who was living on the streets and how he felt doing this work. Here's what he said.
I've been in this neighborhood 49 years, so I have a great understanding of it. Some of my own people are out here. Some of my friends are people I knew through all my life are out here, you know what I mean? This is my neighborhood. From young to old, I know them. So it's a great experience.
And he really did know the people that we were meeting along the trail. I think the barriers between the folks who are living outside and the folks who are providing the aid are really low.
Mm, that's great. You know, because that opens up a window of hopefully progress and healing. At the root of this is kind of like a medical or healthcare term. It's called ACEs, and that stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences. What are they and why are they important?
ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, fall into three categories: abuse, neglect, and household challenges. And they can include physical and verbal abuse, emotional neglect, or having a family member who is mentally ill, addicted, or incarcerated, among many other factors. These are experiences that happen when you're young, but they can affect your stress response, your coping mechanisms, your mental health for the rest of your life. And the CDC has found that more ACEs tend to correlate with higher rates of chronic illness, mental illness, and substance use. So people with a lot of ACEs are more likely to be smokers, drinkers, users, etc.
Mm. And in this context, the nonprofit Neighborhood Wellness, they're approaching people who are currently unhoused with a better way to understand what's behind these drug addictions. What are they asking and why is this a game changer for them?
So the team speaks a lot about how traumas that you experience when you're young can affect you physically, biologically, mentally for the rest of your life. So they're asking questions about abuse in the household, neglect, incarceration. And they're trying to get people to understand that those experiences might be affecting them now. And it's something they do with housed neighbors, unhoused neighbors, really all sorts of people. But this is kind of specifically also about folks who use drugs. Here's how Gina Warren puts it.
We want them to understand what happened to them, that there's nothing wrong with them, but a lot has happened. So now when you are aware of it and you say, okay, so what do I do about it though, right? Because I can't take away my experience, but I can take control back of my life.
So that is really at the crux, getting people to realize and then connecting them to resources from there.
So what happens if a staff member or volunteer goes out, they're asking these questions, and then they do learn that there has been past trauma or harm in someone's past? What is the next step?
So it's immediately validating people's experiences, telling them it could be contributing to why they're experiencing adverse effects as adults, and then inviting them to a healing circle, which Gina Warren called a big old therapy session with food. There's a lot of laughter, a lot of people who have known and loved each other for a long time. These take place every Wednesday at 10 a.m. at Neighborhood Wellness. And they're done in part because it's really hard to help people have access to mental health treatment, even though a lot of people probably need it. Here's how Gina Warren describes it.
We don't have a therapist all the time. And so we create therapeutic web. We create a therapeutic space so people can begin the process of healing. But awareness is critical, because if you know from where it's coming, when you feel that anger and that rage coming on, from where is it coming? So now you're developing skills and tools and protective factors. So now when you are out in that space and you get triggered again, you have more control.
And it's important to mention that although there is or can be childhood trauma or past experiences of harm or trauma, when you're unhoused, it's often likely that you continue to get re-traumatized. It's a very difficult and dangerous living situation for people who don't have housing.
Definitely.
So are there plans to make it easier for unhoused people to attend these healing circles?
Right. So Dr. Warren really wants to bring those healing circles out to the unhoused neighbors in Del Paso Heights. And I think they're working on making that happen and seeing how that goes.
Hmm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're speaking with CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf, who is talking about how homeless outreach workers are trying to get to the root of the drug crisis by asking different questions and changing their approach. When it comes to outreach workers using information they collect about ACEs, how are they doing that? How are they going about that?
So there's a need to collect data because this helps inform how to tackle the problem, how to respond to certain issues people are having. And as Gina Warren says, she sees the effect of healing circles and the work that is, you know, happening in people's lives all the time. But if they don't have data on what's going on, there's less potential for funding and less potential for replication in other areas.
Yeah, or also just anecdotal. Like you need to have something quantitative.
Exactly.
Adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. I mean, this was also a big initiative by the former Surgeon General for California, but also for California's first partner, Jennifer Siebel Newsom. You know, what do they say about the continuing need for data?
Yeah, California's first Surgeon General, Nadine Burke-Harris, was really well known for this work, probably her legacy linking toxic stress as children to adverse health outcomes as adults. And she launched an effort to reimburse doctors to screen Medi-Cal patients for ACEs. So really stressing that if we can screen people early in their lives and throughout, we can figure out treatment plans for people, give advice early, and maybe interrupt patterns of trauma. And there's always need for more data here. As a healthcare reporter, I certainly would be really eager to see more insights about how these social-emotional factors affect people's physical health.
I actually noticed that change at a recent trip to the doctor's office. I actually got a form, you know, filling out, you know, something about ACEs. And now I know that it goes into, you know, more data collection so they get a better understanding of how to combat and reduce the harm from this issue. Back to the fentanyl crisis in Sacramento County, what is the most immediate need right now in the community?
I spoke with Lori Miller, who heads the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Services Division of Sacramento County's Health Department. A bit of a mouthful there. But they are trying to figure out targeted approaches. Right now, it's Narcan. It's an opioid reversal medicine, which anyone can buy now at the pharmacy. That's a pretty new development. It can be expensive without insurance, so you should see if your insurance will cover it in a part. But Narcan is really the message getting that out. Here's what Lori Miller said.
Everyone should equip themselves with Narcan because it could be their neighbor, it could be their coworker, it could be somebody that they're out in the community, you know, at the mall or attending a movie or something, and somebody has a substance that is laced or replaced with fentanyl.
So that's the main thing they're advising. Know the signs of an overdose, pinpoint pupils, slowed breathing, and know that you could be giving Narcan, have Narcan on you.
Especially because you led in the conversation by saying, you know, of the more than 200 deaths related to fentanyl, I mean, it doesn't just impact the house community. The majority are within people who have homes, and it really touches potentially every single household and demographic. But you also mentioned that there is a large disparity with fentanyl use among the African-American community. Why is that? Can you expand on it?
Right. Lori said that more Black people are dying from fentanyl-related causes than ever before. Black folks make up 10% of Sacramento County. And at this point, they're 26% of fentanyl-related deaths. So that's a big reason that Neighborhood Wellness was doing this outreach effort. It was actually their first outreach effort, giving Narcan to unhoused folks that I went along with. And the county is also watching how youth and young adults in all racial groups, but specifically in among Black youth, could be vulnerable. And they've launched a One Pill Can Kill campaign, which hopefully folks have seen messaging for, that's talking about how to be careful among any drugs that is not actively prescribed to you.
So the county is like an umbrella, and under that umbrella are nonprofits and organizations like Neighborhood Wellness. Do they work well together, or is there room for improvement?
I think the relationship has gotten much better. I asked Warren about the relationship with the county, and she drew a parallel to the COVID vaccine rollout, and that a lot has been done since the COVID vaccine rollout, when trusted messengers were really crucial to get the word out. So here's what she said about that.
If you don't have people in the community helping to make sure that folks in the community were vaccinated, it wouldn't have happened. It requires everyone. And until you value what happens in a community, in the neighborhood, and on the ground, then you won't see any changes. And that includes violence mitigation, that includes educational attainment, it includes, you know, the whole fentanyl poisoning, the whole fentanyl crisis, the homeless crisis. You have to value the people who are closest to the problem.
Given that you shadowed these volunteers and staff workers along the Sacramento Northern Bike Trail in Del Paso Heights, I mean, you put foot to pavement. What stuck with you? What struck you after visiting there?
I hadn't spent much time over there, and I was surprised by the number of folks living along that trail. I mean, probably north of 100 people are living along that bike trail. I was also seeing folks work together, look out for each other. A large portion of those people who are unhoused don't use drugs, are just out there because of economic circumstance. I was struck by the resilience, economic circumstances, and I'll also say a lack of affordable housing. I was struck by the resilience of the people who were there. And I know there's many other groups that come through and give food and give supplies to people. And there's a lot of love. There's a lot of desire to help people, make sure people are provided for. I think a healing circle is a beautiful plan. And it's only one piece of what has to be a multi-systems effort to get people housed and get people feeling fulfilled. But it was a really amazing experience to go out and see this therapeutic web at work.
Chipping away at the root of the problem.
Exactly.
Kate, thank you.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
Kate Wolf is Cap Radio's healthcare reporter. You can read Kate's digital article at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This year's snowstorms were a game changer, from dampening or delaying the risk of devastating wildfires to recharging the groundwater and filling up our reservoirs. Every single snowflake was desperately needed. Now that we're deep into summer, all of that snow has turned into water, giving California's drought-stricken landscape new life. Agriculture is thriving again, and salmon populations are improving. Burn scars are showing signs of rebirth, and historic native lands overrun by decades of logging and ranching are being revived. There's no better example of the impact and importance of snowmelt than the Feather River. While the Feather may not be the most well-known river in California, like the Sacramento, it is vital to the overall health of the state. The San Francisco Chronicle recently traced the snowmelt's path from the headwaters of the Feather River all the way into the San Francisco Bay. The vivid digital piece tells the story of the so-called Big Melt. Natural resources reporter Curtis Alexander and photographer Carlos Avila Gonzalez spent 4 months following the Big Melt, and join us with more about the benefits and the impact for all of us. Welcome to you both. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Curtis, I want to start with you. Before we get into the reporting, take us behind the scenes a little bit. Your report calls the Feather River one of the most important rivers in the state. What piqued your interest?
Yeah, as you noted, it's not the most popular river in the state. It's not the longest. It's not the fastest flowing, but it is one of the most important for any number of reasons, for drinking water, for farming and ranching, for hydroelectric power generation, for Native American significance, for recreation. The list goes on. And it's also just an incredibly beautiful river. And, you know, I will say that in terms of all the benefits that these rivers provide, the Feather's emblematic of all river watersheds in the state. They provide a lot of benefits, not only in the regions that they flow, but because the water is pumped and flows across the state, they're benefiting farms and cities from the Oregon border to Southern California. Mm.
Carlos, you're the visual arm in this. There's so much to cover. I mean, as Curtis said, I mean, the Feather River starts, you know, just south of the Oregon border. It goes to the headwaters of the San Francisco Bay. What conversations did you have about where to begin?
Yeah, that was actually at the very beginning, we had really not mapped out anything and basically got the starting gun to go get this project started literally 2 days before the final snowstorm. So we had to rush up there and just start getting footage and finding ways to, you know, really show the impact of the tremendous snowpack that we had. So within 2 days, I'm rushing up to Mount Lassen, to the places where I could get into, because it was just so inundated with snow. I couldn't even stop on some roads to get pictures that I really wanted to get, because the pullout lanes were, you know, 5-6 feet deep in snow. You know, and it was really just at the very beginning, you know, just capturing that and getting that last snowfall and getting the things that were going to eventually lead into the, you know, more visual elements of the story further down the river, because we had to have a place setter. And beginning up at Mount Lassen was really our goal, showing some of those 20-foot, 30-foot high snowbanks on the side of the road. You know, trying not to fall in the snow too often, or, you know, I'm a pretty big guy, so I kept finding myself waist deep in some of these drifts. But yeah, and then, you know, once we set the table, it was just about a matter of finding the places where we needed to really focus the human element, the people, the communities that were impacted by this. And then we started to really flesh out the the little nodes that we really wanted to touch upon and find the people that you know, showed those the best.
This project took 4 months, you know, and I can imagine during that 4 months, you're just keeping your head down, churning away. You know, Carlos, when you closed in on those 4 months and you were just touching upon the very beginning when you had to rush up there with tons and tons of snow, you know, how did you look back on the reporting project?
You know, I really felt really good about it because I think we had gone up there with such a clean slate that was really just a you know, an open field for us to kind of fill. And I think we got in touch with the right people who knew where to go, what to do, who to talk to, and gave us contacts that really humanized these elements of the story. I was really happy with the work we did along the Middle Fork, because that was a real struggle, just being able to get into some of these areas because it is so inaccessible. And also just, you know, the Greenville, the burn scar of the Dixie Fire was just, you know, heartbreaking to see some of these folks rebuilding out there. And just knowing that it's been years for them trying to get this done and then to get, you know, kind of swamped by all this snow. But yeah, it was, you know, seeing little things like the salmon being released into the San Francisco Bay was really cool. But also being able to see how the folks up at the hatchery at Oroville were taking the time to get these fish healthier. And, you know, it's all this amazing process to, you know, to bring this all together.
Mm. The way that the project, the piece, is laid out is vivid. It's very interesting. Curtis, you're a natural resources reporter, so, you know, you have a good amount of familiarity with the Feather River and its impact. And you laid out this reporting by breaking it up into sections. You know, Carlos touched upon some of them, the North Fork, then the Middle Fork, then the Sacramento Valley Delta, and then finally the San Francisco Bay. What struck you most, you know, during this trajectory of months long reporting?
Well, there was a lot that sort of reinforced what I'd known about the Feather River and its importance. As you mentioned, it's an incredibly diverse watershed, starting up where the Cascades from the Pacific Northwest sort of peter out and the Sierra Nevada picks up. It's just a few thousand square miles of mountains that sends snow and creek water down several branches through canyons and vast meadows and thick forests. You know, one of the things that struck me, and we had kind of known this, but you don't really realize this until you're up there, is just how much of this vast watershed burned. You know, there were, you know, Northern California, you know, historically was this really wet, cold place that didn't see these big mega fires that were associated with like Southern California and the Central and Southern Sierra. But over the past 5 years, more than half of the watershed has burned. We had the Camp Fire in 2018, which until the Maui fires was the deadliest fire in the past 100 years in the U.S. And then 2 years ago, we had the Dixie Fire, which approached 1 million acres. And that fire has really affected the people and the landscape, but the people who live up there. Many have had to move out because their homes burned or their communities burned or they lost their place of work. I remember one conversation I had with a guy named Larry Yoakum in Greenville. That community was devastated by the Dixie Fire. And, you know, he was up there one of the times we were up there. And he's been forced to move outside of Redding, which is more than at the outskirts of Redding, which is more than an hour away. But he comes up to Greenville as often as he can just to try to get that sense of connection. He's kind of hoping to rebuild. He's begun the process, hasn't gotten very far, and he admits that he might not rebuild. But it's just sort of that hope that is keeping him going. And there's just a lot of people that are just finding ways to try to put their life back together.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking about what used to be, you know, lush, green, you know, what areas? I mean, an interesting statistic in your reporting, I mean, you said that 75%, I believe, of California's rain, it falls north of Sacramento, yet 80% of water demand is south of Sacramento. And this has long been a contentious issue when it comes to water. You know, how is that impacting people who live in Greenville or live in Sierra or Plumas counties, you know, knowing that, you know, those water demands still exist south of us?
I think people in the North are happy to share the water because they've historically gotten so much of it. But as you mentioned, it is a contentious issue. And as we have increasing droughts, water is becoming increasingly scarce. And people are going to be less willing to share. And we're seeing these debates pop up all across the state, whether it's the tunnel that's been proposed in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, or just the water restrictions that we all faced over the past 3 years when we had the drought before this big water year. So, I think the people up there, they want to share, but, the changing climate may not allow them to share as much.
Carlos, that brings me to Native and Indigenous communities who have historically, been overlooked, and there's been an impact as well. You spoke with some of the Native Mountain Maidu. What did they say about the importance of water and how climate change has impacted their lands?
You know, one of the people that we spoke with, Trina Cunningham, she was, one of the tribal chairperson a couple of years ago, and she mentioned that most of their essence, their spiritual, community revolved around the river and around these creeks that that fed life and gave them life. And we were, trying to really convey that through images. And we ended up talking to her, and she sang their water song for us. Initially, we were trying to see if they were going to do their spring ceremony, which is done at the river's edge. And unfortunately, there was just too much. They had to cancel it, I believe, during COVID, and had not really started doing it again. But it really is emblematic of how connected they are and how these lands and regions surrounding the water and, even the meadow that was returned to them from PG&E several years ago, I think it was 2019, how it's being restored, seeing the care that's going into this is really, it's beautiful to see, because you can see the regrowth, the regeneration of the types of plant life and animals that they need to survive. And I think it's really an amazing change to see how much that water has affected that, and how these folks who are building beaver dam analogs are impacting the slowing down of the water through these meadows and rebuilding them.
Yeah, there's still a lot to learn, even with all the preparation and research that you did ahead of this trip.
Yeah, a lot of it was done on the fly, I'll admit that. But we did do a lot of phone calls and, text messages, emails, and just prepping ourselves to get, into being able to really, communicate appropriately with all of the groups involved, because a lot of that is, getting people to trust you and letting you not just into the Native American communities, but also into these places where, there's, like I said, the Dixie Fire, the devastation there. How do you approach that, knowing that it's going to be a struggle on a lot of different fronts?
Curtis, I only have about 30 seconds left. What would you like readers to feel and know when they're finished with this digital piece?
Well, I think there's a few takeaways here, but I'll just mention one. And I think this was top of mind when we were reporting up there, is that we've seen these increasing weather extremes in California in recent years. And just being up there during this really wet period when people had endured storms and some places flooding and closed roads because of landslides, they were still talking about the drought and they were worrying about when the next drought was going to come. And I think this awareness of the changing climate and even anxiety is really something.
Curtis and Carlos, thank you. Thanks for the trip and sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Curtis Alexander is the natural resources reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Carlos Avila Gonzalez is a photographer and multimedia producer. We have posted a link to their work at capradio.org/insight. And that's it for Insight today. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.